You figure I'd learn how to do this by now.
I'm impressed you've made it this far.
Right? Jump right in here. Joe, before we get started, you're back from vacation. Tell us about your vacation.
Yeah. Me and my girlfriend went to Puerto Vallarta. We were there for 5 days and four nights. I was drunk for 5 days and four nights. It was pretty fucking good.
Right on.
Yeah. We were at the Hotel Ziva. Had a sort of a quote-unquote private beach. Like, it's still public, but the only way to get there is through the hotel or with a boat. So it was pretty remote. I really just didn't do shit for 5 days. It was quite nice. I very much enjoyed it.
Hang on the beach, that's it?
Pretty much. Like, we went into the city. We ate in the city. But for the most part, yeah, we hung on a beach for five straight days.
I have to test something you said on a previous episode. Did anybody confuse you for a local?
Absolutely everyone I spoke with.
For real?
Yeah. Like,
how do you know?
Because they would just speak to me in Spanish.
Oh.
Yeah.
My theory is that people can't. Joe thinks people think he's Hispanic, and I always say they don't because I just know him. I know he's black. But he thinks it does, and obviously he's right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Like any vendor, like they immediately spoke to me in Espanol, and I was like, no Espanol. They immediately spoke to me in English, but they always assumed I spoke Spanish. Like, every person I met assumed I spoke Spanish. So now I want to learn Spanish. Like, it'd be a good, you know, tool to have.
And when I did, as I said.
Yeah.
All right, so today we got to talk about not fun things, that travel and vacation. Originally, this was going to be our travel episode because Joe was back from vacation and we're going to swap stories about, you know, going places.
Yeah.
But we took a turn here, and so just for sake of introduction, my beautiful, intelligent, super understanding wife is on the call with us today. Christina, say hi to our audience.
Hi.
And originally, because she's super well-traveled, she was going to be our guest speaker, guest moderator for the travel episode, but given everything that's been happening in the news lately with the Catholic Church, and the fact that she was raised Catholic and has a lot of strong feelings about the Catholic Church, we decided to change directions and talk about those particular scandals. Does anybody want to add anything to that? Did I cover that?
I mean, I guess this is still sort of a travel episode. It's just for monsters.
Oh, man. All right, with that being said, I'm going to... I guess just for the sake of whoever's on the same page, most likely people know about this already, but the Attorney General's office released a report from back in the day saying that 300 priests molested 1,000 children that they know of. The details are pretty crazy. I have some of the lowlights here pulled up on my screen, which we'll pepper in, you know, throughout, because I think, I mean, maybe a lot of what you guys think. I've been going back and forth about whether or not reading some of these on the air, because it's pretty disturbing, so we should definitely warn our audience. But I think looking the other way is why this keeps happening, so I don't know if reading some of these is actually not doing that, or if I'm just being salacious, but my inclination is to read some of these just to have them out there and not continuously look away. Then, of course, there's the one in Ireland. And this was not a molestation one, because the Catholic Church decided that they can't just abuse children, they can also bury them in mass graves, because a Catholic care home, which is like an orphanage in Ireland, over the years they have had 800 child deaths reported. I'm trying to get this right, so I don't want to misspeak. 800 child deaths reported since the 50s. And with no indication about where the bodies were. and they have just unearthed a mass child grave at the site of the facility with children as young as 35 weeks, which I guess is about 4 months, and as old as 3 years old. Now, these were children that were taken from single mothers, prostitutes, or orphans. There are reports of neglect and abuse. I think one of the struggles with this site, at least for me, is understanding exactly what the stakes are of it. Because with the Pennsylvania one, it's obvious. 1,000 children at least molested. This one, they did report the children were dead. It turns out they were just buried them in a marked grave, probably just throw them out back in a pile, which doesn't seem very religious in terms of what to do with the remains of a person, but it's not like, I don't know if they're accusing them of being responsible for the deaths. It certainly feels like they are. I don't know.
I mean, that many kids in that amount of time, it seems like, yeah, it seems like something's questionable is going on.
Yeah, I mean, 800 kids since 1950, I don't know what the math is there. Is that like 5 a year?
Yeah, it's definitely more than one.
All right, so Christina, you know, I hate to put you on the spot, but we did organize this because part of the reason you and me have been talking about it all week, and we finally decided we should just put it on the air. Do you want to get us started? How do we even start talking about this?
Well, I think this is one of those things that it's hard to say we should start talking about this because it feels like we should have always been talking about this. When you go back and look at these reports, it's not as if these are the first reports coming out this week or this month. And even if we go back to that 2002 initial story that the Boston Globe broke in Boston, which hits, you know, close to home for me being from that area, that was also not the first time that these stories were made public. I think I've gone back and done some research, and it seems like it was at least the mid-80s that these stories have been out and in the press. And so the crazy thing to me is the amount of shock that people are expressing over these stories now. Certainly the details from that Pennsylvania report that has just come out are shocking. But it feels like to me that we should have seen it coming insofar as this has just been going on for so long. And so I don't even know if that's an answer to a question or what I'm trying to say, except that I certainly have been thinking about these issues for a long time. And I know I've been dragging my feet as a Catholic in confronting these issues or thinking about these issues. And I said as a Catholic because I was raised Catholic. My family's Catholic. And as a child and a young adult, I went to a Catholic college and I liked being Catholic. I was never one of those people who resented it. I enjoyed it. And, you know, some people, might share those feelings. Some people might think that's crazy, but, you know, either way, that's how it was. But at this point, I feel like, you know, for the last 10 years, I've been asking myself whether or not I can or should still call myself a Catholic. And I think I came to the decision several years ago that I could not and should not, but I have not necessarily made that public, especially to people who know me well. And I feel like part of the reason we've been having so many conversations about this at home over the last week or so is because I feel like there should be a way to divorce the Catholic Church. Like, I feel like I was brought into this at a young age, right? And the equivalent of whatever you might want to call that final seal on that relationship comes at confirmation, which for me happened in eighth grade. So as an eighth grader, I pledged my life to the Catholic Church. I would like to revisit that decision and kind of undo that. That feels like that was awfully young. But anyways, I just feel like I can't call myself Catholic anymore. Yeah. And that's not something, I guess, that's easy to say, and it's also not something I'm sort of cheering and saying, you know, it's just one of those painful, awful things that it's like, I cannot be a part of this. About 10 years ago, I felt like I had to start introducing myself if anyone asked about religion by saying, I'm Catholic, but I don't support that stuff that you're hearing about in the news. I'm Catholic, but I don't hate you because you're gay. I'm Catholic, but I am a feminist, right? And that but list has gotten so long.
The but list has gotten really long.
Yeah.
I mean, that is true.
Yeah, it's like, how many addendums do you have to add to something before the original thing just isn't true anymore, right? I'm Catholic, but I reject most of the teachings. So am I Catholic at all? And the answer is basically, I think, no. Yeah. And this week, just hearing about all these things going on and hearing, you know, the good people in the world I know who are Catholic, and there are some good people who are practicing the Catholic faith.
Shout out to James Martin. That guy, Bishop James Martin.
Yeah.
That guy's the best.
And there are many people within, it's a minority, but there are many people within the Catholic Church who are being extremely vocal and advocating for change. And so there are people who see this as an enterprise that is not lost, right? But my fundamental problem with that as a woman is that there are basically no rights in the Catholic Church for women to enact any change whatsoever. And people might quibble with that and say you could do a variety of different things to sort of speak and have your voice be heard. But the reality is that time and time again, women have been denied roles of leadership or power within the Catholic Church. Not that I would want one of those particularly anyway, but there's just no space for me. That's probably why I don't want one, because I don't want to be a part of the Catholic Church anymore. But there's just no space for this. And people who had a lot of high hopes in Pope Francis, who has now been Pope for a little over 5 years, you know, he has a kind face, a nice demeanor. And I think many of the things he does, he's trying to do good things, but he's affirmed again and again, at least on two counts that are really important to me, that he is not capable of leading the Catholic Church forward. One is that he continually refuses to allow women a space in the Catholic Church, and he has reiterated that numerous times, saying basically that he respects women deeply, but there is no space for them to ever become members of the clergy, to even become deacons, which is sort of a secondary level of the clergy. They're not clergy, but they can't do things like hold a mass, but they have a lot of leadership roles in communities where priests aren't there, or in communities where there are priests. So women can't even do that. And that's a closed book. There is this sort of council right now that's looking into the role of women earlier in the church, because apparently there were female deacons in the very, very early days of the church, but that is a purely historical mission. Everything I've read about that, there's no connection to any possible future rights for women. And secondly, while I appreciate that Pope Francis has said things like he's outraged, there's a failure to act there that I just can't get on board with. So I appreciate the acknowledgement, because that is something that was not always there, but that's not enough, and it's way too late.
But even he's now being accused of being one of the ones who covered it up. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's an interesting story, because the person who is putting forth those allegations is an interesting person. So that's kind of splitting a lot of reactions currently in the Catholic Church. And I don't know what
I think. The Carlo Vigano guy, or I don't know how to pronounce his name, but yeah.
So he is someone who people say has a score to settle with the Pope. And so there's some doubt being cast over whether or not he did this with the purest of intentions. I've read some reports from the National Catholic Reporter, which is an independent newspaper that covers Catholicism in the Vatican, which says that he's not a very trustworthy character in and of himself. He's notoriously anti-gay and has sort of peppered that report, allegedly, I haven't read it, with really negative and discriminatory things that he's writing about gay people. So I don't know how that relates or doesn't relate to what's going on. In any case, there's been this seed of doubt that's been planted. And so in some ways, I'm interested in that insofar as whether Pope Francis knew about McCarrick. That's, I think, important, but it's almost beside the point, because whether or not he knew, there's enough other stuff, I think, that's worth addressing.
Yeah.
Like, certainly, you know, the thing is whether or not he knew about McCarrick. The Boston Globe story came out in 2002, and these stories have been published since the 80s. So the fact that continually popes have not acted, it's like, I don't care whether you knew or didn't know at a certain point. We all know now. This is news to no one.
I got a lot to say about what we've been saying here. Number one, you knew the new pope was in trouble when he changed his name away from Jorge. This is right out the gate. Stumbling heart.
Okay.
Number two, it really says something that, let's say that this guy who's accusing the Pope is using this, seeing a political moment, right, to take out an enemy. Let's say that he's lying. Let's just assume that for the sake of this next idea. we still have to take the accusation seriously, and he knows it, because so many priests are involved in some way or another, either in hiding it or doing it. And that, I think, says something that we have to really wonder about every single priest that you know. You have to wonder. If we take the sort of stats at their word, and it's about 5% of all priests that are doing things. First of all, there's 400,000 priests, so that's like 20,000, right? Worldwide. So, and they're each doing three kids apiece all the time. Like, Jesus.
What an awful way to say that.
Yeah, that was...
No, yeah, well, I didn't even realize that. Oh, man. I can't wait for me to be the real villain of this episode, given all the people we're talking about. Okay, you're going to do something. If it's less than excommunication, I don't want to hear it. Like, what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do? Most of these people are going to get away with it because the statute of limitations is over. We can't prosecute them. I think of the 300 Pennsylvania priests, charges have been brought to two. Like, come on. First of all, we obviously reassess the statute of limitations on stuff like this, right? It should not expire. If we ever find out you're a pedophile, you're in trouble. Yeah.
That should never expire.
But the church doesn't make laws, but the church makes its own interior rules. And if these men aren't excommunicated, then I don't understand how we can take you seriously. And as non-Catholics, and I think, Joe, I know you're non-Catholic. I'm a non-Catholic, although I was raised somewhat Catholic. I went to religious school, so I was going to like Protestant schools and then Catholic schools in the weekend, or Catholic church in the weekend. And eventually I just stopped going to Catholic church because it's just more efficient to go to the one I was already at school for, right? I just didn't want to waste my weekend. Really why I didn't do it. I don't understand how we permit the Catholic Church to exist anymore. Like, at what point is that just a completely cancerous institution? Like, I'm not saying don't be Catholic or abolish Catholicism. This is not an anti-religion. Be Catholic if you're going to be Catholic, you know? But the Catholic Church, as an organization, as a power structure, has to just be burned to the ground at this point, right? Like, I don't see what's left. Or else we're just going to be okay with this keeping happening, because I don't see consequences other than ruined reputations.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem, right? So there's been, even those in the church who are in higher powers of authority who have supported consequences or imposed sanctions or whatever kinds of punishments have been deemed appropriate on people who have on clergy members who have abused children or others, because there's this huge other issue of different members of the clergy abusing seminarians. So men who are of age but are studying in seminary, right? So they're older than 18, but still they're in a position of they're not in a position of authority, and these priests are in a position of authority who are training them. So even if there are punishments and consequences, they're not harsh enough, and there's no systematic way of dealing with these things. Even those who have been in favor of holding people accountable for their actions have been content to let that happen on the local level by some governing body that is other than the Vatican, which is where all of these laws and decrees come from. So whether it's the local government, as in the government, the municipal government of the country or the state where these actions took place, or whether it's a more local council of the Catholic Church, so say like a conference of bishops, which has the power and authority to, you know, make rules or rulings for a small area of Catholicism, not for the larger religion. So it would be like saying, like, we're happy to let Rhode Island take care of itself and not let that, whatever Rhode Island is doing, sort of reverberate throughout the larger United States, if we were to use that analogy. And so there absolutely has to be something coming from the Vatican that says there are consequences in addition to legal consequences in whatever country you're in. There are consequences. You can no longer be a clergy member. Cardinal Law from Boston was promoted to the Vatican as a way of dealing with that scandal, yeah. Right? And he had a burial at the Vatican when he died. About 6 or so months ago. So there's no mechanism for dealing with this.
Yeah. I think, and it's probably going to sound awful, but I get why they buried it until 2002. Like, if we find out, like, I understand their thinking on that. Like, if people know that priests are molesting kids, the Catholic Church reputation is going to be ruined. But then after it comes out, when it's already ruined, they kept doing that. So then it makes you think, okay, is this just an organized crime organization by pedophiles to enable pedophiles? Because essentially that's what it is. And now we're, what, over 10 years from the big story. Now we have another big story, and it's still the same shit. So it's just a place to enable pedophiles.
Either by consequence or design, doesn't really matter which, right?
Yeah,
and I mean, I've read some things by priests who claim to be good priests, and, you know, I'm not going to start questioning everyone or doubt people who claim that they have done nothing wrong. But they say this impacts them really negatively, too, that there are a lot of local priests who are like, should I wear my collar when I go out, right? Because does that identify me as someone who I'm not? I mean, this hurts. This hurts good Catholics as much as it hurts, I think, anyone else.
You'll forgive me, honestly, if I'm unmoved by that.
This is part of why I'm saying I can't be Catholic anymore, right? But
that's also the power of that kind of belief system that's instilled in you from being a child. Like, I'll compare it to Trump people. Trump has made people who held on to these long beliefs just forego it all because of this institution. Like, he's a Republican, I'm a Republican, I'm going to go with all of the bullshit he does. And that's what Catholics are still stuck in. And I get that because I was raised religious. It wasn't Catholic, but my dad's family was Catholic. I was raised Baptist, and that shit fucking did a number to me that I still can't kick. Like, I wouldn't say I'm religious, but I still have a place in my heart for Jesus Christ, you know? And that's something that happened because it was instilled in me through church. And it's hard to kick that. And I'm not going to shit on somebody who's still struggling with that. But I'm not Catholic, so I'm not dealing with that same kind of burden.
Yeah, it's a crazy thing, right? So there's this whole, like, there's a couple different pieces to it. It's layered. It's, do I want to be Catholic anymore? The answer is no. Does that negate my belief in the things I grew up believing as a Catholic, as in believing in God, which is, I don't think, intrinsically tied to the Catholic Church. Certainly people believe in God in a variety of different denominations, right? And so for me, those two things are separate, and I've been able to separate those out. And I do believe in God, and have a whole separate, you know, set of issues with that. But I can say that I do believe in God, but the Catholic Church I no longer believe in, and that's a whole other thing. And even just saying that, you know, I keep repeating it, and I'm like, maybe I'll get more comfortable with it the more I say it. But it's a crazy sort of thing, because that has been, for me, the cultural place where the two sides of my family have met. My dad is Irish Catholic, and his whole family Catholic, raised Catholic. My dad's great-grandfather came from Ireland to the Boston area, and so that was very much instilled in him. My dad was an altar boy. I grew up, you know, doing readings at church. I wasn't an altar girl, but I was still very involved with the church. And on my mom's side, they were Catholic in the former Yugoslavia. During World War II, members of my mom's family were allegedly, and I'm not sure the exact nuance of this, but they were put into concentration camps for being Catholic, right? So they were definitely in concentration camps. I know that much for sure. They were at Mauthausen and then at a work camp in Padua. But I've been told that is either entirely or partially because they identified as Catholic, and that nuance on the ground was being played out with these different political groups who had different religious affiliations. So I've never actually confirmed that per se, but that's the story that's been told, and that's been very powerful. And so to turn around and tell my mother or grandmother who claimed they came to the United States for a variety of reasons, including, you know, economic opportunities, but to be able to freely practice their religion of Catholicism, because during communism, they could not openly practice any religion, including Catholicism. My mother was baptized in secret in a church basement. And I went to visit that church about 10 or so years ago. And so did the whole pilgrimage back to see where everything was. But to turn around and tell them that I'm not Catholic, it feels like it echoes deeper in some ways than just saying I no longer want to affiliate myself with one group or another. But even so, and that's what gave me such a struggle for so long, this sort of legacy of my family. But even so, it's like, this stuff is just not okay. And I can't be associated with it. This has kind of turned into a personal rant. I apologize for that. But I'm really irritated. Not irritated doesn't even begin to cover it. I'm so anchored.
Dedicated listeners will know that we are pro-rant on Tucsonians.
Well, no, I guess I was just going to say, to cap it off, I am so angered. I do not want to or see the point of trying to change the church from within. It is not, to me, worth doing.
It's got to go. It's just got to go. You know, something you too powerful. Go back to something you said earlier, too powerful,
too privileged,
too rich.
Yeah.
And that's where you start. You said something about, like, you can't do much of an effect at a local level. I would counter that there is one thing, and I don't know how this would work at the state level. It would probably have to go to, have to get national level somehow. But revoking the churches, the Catholic churches, revoking their tax-free status.
Every church should have their tax-free status revoked.
Yeah, probably. But at least on the one hand, it's a nice card to play. When you tell them that they don't get a role in government because you're not chipping in, so you don't get to have a role in. Like, you don't, as a church, as an individual, sure. Obviously, that's your right. As an organization, no. If your organization isn't paying taxes, you don't get a say in how we run things.
Mm-hmm.
You're not chipping in. If you're not kicking in rent, you don't get to decide, you know, what we're watching on TV. Like, you have to just relax and go along for the ride. So you start revoking, but the Catholic Church, absolutely revoke their church status, And if anything, just to chase them out of here. And if you want to be Catholic, be Catholic. Say the Mass, you know, eat the cracker, the transubstantiation. To quote Charlie Day from Always Sunny, it's interesting that you believe that Jesus comes back every week as a bowl of crackers and you welcome him home by eating him. But do it. If that's what you believe, go for it. But the Catholic Church is the institution, that pyramid scheme where you're kicking up all this money, it's got to go. And if the secular community has to do it for you through, you know, the legal system, we're going to. Because one thing I keep coming back to is I went to confirmation. First communion. And I went to confirmation classes, although I quit because I just didn't give a shit. Honestly, I didn't quit so much as stop going, right? Just, you know, weed and music was more interesting, right? But one thing I thought about, I was like, holy shit, every time I was in that building, I was just like prey. I was just sexual prey, just walking down the aisle all the time. And it just makes you think, like, holy crap, I was in serious danger every time I was in a church. Because you are. Because if they don't molest you themselves, they'll hide the ones who did. They will cover their asses. It's, for me, it's like something I said before, it's almost, there's something about it that it's so male that it's part of this, because dudes cover for other dudes. They always act like they don't. Dudes always act like, oh, I'm a little wolf, or I do it on my own. We have all this mythology about the single guy who does everything. But push comes to shove, homies will fucking lie for homies, and sometimes we just should not, because holy shit, like, at some point, you just have to say something, and if you're not going to, then fuck you.
Yeah. And see, so my whole family was Catholic on my dad's side. So, like, all my uncles were Catholic. So I've always, like, when I was a child, I was told, don't go anywhere alone with the priest. Like, my uncle was an altar boy.
Are you serious?
Yeah, he would joke about it. He was like, yeah, don't go up there with Father Tyson. Like, he would joke about it because he was an altar boy. And, like, all my life, like, when it came out, I wasn't surprised. I was like, oh, yeah, that's what fucking uncles would joke about. But yeah, like, my uncle blamed it for his alcoholism more than anything, because he was sneaking slips of the wine. But they would joke about, like, that was a thing. Like, they were from a tiny town of fucking 1,100 people, but they didn't fuck with the priest, because they knew that about him.
Wow.
And so it was always just a matter of fact to me.
Wow.
At any point, so with that, I think it's a good segue into reading some of these lowlights. I'm just going to do a couple. I won't do a ton. There's so many choose from, but I do want to do some of the craziest ones. If at any point you want to respond to the specific one, do it. Or if you want me to just shut the fuck up, tell me. One priest abused all five sisters from the same family and kept samples of their urine, pubic hair, and menstrual blood. One priest in Harrisburg raped a 7-year-old girl in the hospital after her tonsils were removed. That's gotta be the worst thing I've ever heard until the next one.
I do want to say something about those two. I'm glad you started with girls, because I think girls have been left out of this scandal quite a bit, that girls were abused. I think it's sort of a weird sexist thing, and gay panic also. that we only really talk about the boys who were abused. We don't really mention the girls in these conversations.
That's a great point, right? It makes it, for that community, it makes it more salacious because of the homosexual elements of it, which is stupid. Like, it's like, that's not, like, it's, that's not the problem. Two men having sex is fine. A man and any child having sex is not okay.
And a lot of times, this isn't like a gay thing, it's a power thing. Like, some of these priests abuse boys, like, it's, we think about pedophilia in the wrong kind of ways.
I've read or heard, maybe this, no, this is on Spotlight, they were talking about this. And I thought it was a really insightful comment that the reason, or one of the reasons that it's boys, is that boys are less likely to speak out for themselves because they're ashamed.
Shame, yeah.
Girls, we do, like, this is one of those weird moments. Like, one thing I've always complained about or said about, like, I say this to my students, is we teach girls how not to get raped. We have all kinds of lessons for them, right? We don't teach men not to rape, at least not in these sort of cultural ways, like through fairy tales or whatever. I can't think of anyone where that's the moral lesson. With that being said, young girls know how not to get raped. Or at least they're taught how not to. I don't know if they know that. That's a weird phrasing, but you see my point. Yeah. Men aren't. We don't talk about this stuff at all. We don't talk about raping, being raped, being alone with a man. Like, we don't talk about any of that except for this vague, boys shouldn't be too affectionate. Right? Other than that, I never had a conversation about it. I don't know. I mean, you had a joking one.
I'll say this, though. Like, it, you know, as a woman, having been taught to be careful around certain men, that was usually referred to as strangers or men, or at the time, young men my own age, right? Like, never did anyone think to say, oh, and also watch out for people your parents' age. Oh, and also watch out for the local priest, right? So I think that fact that the women who are involved in this as well, yes, I think probably women get more conversations about how to avoid dangerous situations with men, but it, you know, it's usually you don't think, even when you're getting those conversations, you don't think that applies to the priest, someone who's got a role that, you know, that really shouldn't come up.
It's, and I want to just add two of these details, because I think in these details, in these little lowlights, there's a key detail, I think, that to me shocked me when I thought of its implications. And I'll just say these two quick ones. One is that they were known to take photographs of their victims and trade them with each other. And that they would give, quote, favored boys gold cross crucifixes, these specific ones, as presents to sort of mark the child. And then when, and I'm going to read here from CBS News, quote, this is from the report. They were a signal to other predators that the children had been desensitized to sexual abuse and were optimal targets for further victimization. So they were marking boys and sending them off. So they were sharing. All of those are disgusting. But the one thing that really struck me in reflection is they're all hanging out with each other. Like, they're trading pictures, they're buying crosses, they're chumming around. Like, you can't tell me this isn't a corruption of the entire system. Like, this detail, these two details alone prove that not only are they not isolated incidents, not only is it this sort of, it attracts this, you know, that it's a safe haven. It's a, it's even more than a safe haven. It's a club. Like, they're, these pedophiles hanging out together. At some point, pedophiles must have learned, like, oh, I'll just become Catholic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even though they say the numbers are 5 to 6%, which means that there are an awful lot of priests who are not doing this, right? The fact that there are 5 to 6% and they're being moved around so methodically and they're sharing information so easily means that they're, I don't know what the percentage is. Is it 100% who knew this was going on? I'd like to think not. I'd like to think that there are a few good people who could have or tried to do something. Maybe there were a few good people who tried to do something about this who we just haven't heard about because they were stripped of their power or whatever, you know, because they were trying. But it just seems like, again, we've known about this for decades, actually, at this point. So, what the hell? I'm a sailor, hey! And I lost my leg! Climbing up the top sails, I lost my leg!
Moving on then. One thing, so, you know, we've all danced around this on some level or you know, gestured to it in some way. But, you know, to broaden out, to sort of move from this sort of specific moment we're in to something perhaps more philosophical or abstract, spiritual, whatever word you want to use. You know, I'll ask the most basic question, but don't have to answer this directly. You know, ultimately, I want to hear about how you see yourself as a spiritual person, what your beliefs are, your structure, your struggles. But the basic question, and this is reductive, but I think it's in a way that maybe it'll give us a jumping off point, is, do you believe in God? Who wants to go first?
I'll let you go, Christina.
No, you can go ahead. You started.
Well, I mean, I don't know. The one thing I do know is that I don't know shit. So I can't really definitively say, no, like, I can't really write that off. Because just think about what we know about our planet, our solar system, and the universe outside of that. We know fragments, but we really don't understand shit about it. We don't know why it is or what it is. So I can't really pretend that I've written that off, because every day we learn we were wrong about something. So really, I'm more agnostic now than I was, like, just fuck that, no, I don't believe in it. I don't believe in sort of the things we've written down, but I do think I don't know anything.
I'll go?
Sure.
So, I guess to sort of express what my beliefs are, I'm going to answer this a little bit roundaboutly. I do consider myself a Christian. I was raised very religious. And when I say Christian, I mean specifically, I think that the words of Christ are an excellent way to lead your life. I think they're perfect philosophy among many. Like, I don't think it's the only. Sometimes there's this sort of, like, you can only appreciate one religious belief and you can't acknowledge the others, or you cannot choose one. But I've always felt like, no, I can choose one and still admit to the validity of others, right? Just because I drive a Corolla doesn't mean that I don't believe that a Ford Ranger can get there too. Like, I don't see the need to rank mine along somebody else's. With that being said, I do reject most of the Bible because I find it stupid and not useful. So anything that isn't the red letters, I'm just open. It's open to debate as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, I'll let you finish, but I think most of the Bible is open to debate anyway, even if you do believe in God.
Not when you're from Texas.
Okay.
Well, not when you're from Texas. Yeah. So, like, I believe in evolution, obviously, because all the scientists do. I want to disagree with experts. That's, you know, experts can be wrong, but his chances are way better than mine. I don't know fucking shit, like Joseph. With that being said, do I believe in God? No, for two reasons. But one, can there be, like, a first mover? Like, something created all this? Something on the other side of the line where we can't see past the Big Bang? Right? Sure. Right? Can there be a sentient force that can intervene in the universe? I find that unlikely, but I guess it's possible. I can't rule it out, as Joe said, right? I certainly don't have the wherewithal to argue one way or the other. But the sort of, do you believe in God, doesn't only mean do you affirm his existence. It's, at least in the way I was raised, it also means that you put your trust in God. Right? Like it says in our money. And absolutely not. Like, why would you trust God? Like, all evidence to the contrary for everything we started talking about. Like, the notion, like, the idea that there's a God, or even his ascension force, I can swallow. The idea that that force knows my name and loves me is fucking ridiculous. That is some narcissistic nonsense. God does not love you. God does not know your name, and he does not hear your prayers. Live by the words of Christ, because that's a good way to treat other people, and we can create a form of heaven through that. But all this, like prayer? No, dude.
Unless you're evil.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, sometimes miracles... See, miracles happen. I do believe miracles happen. I believe in miracles, in these improbable, unexplainable, beautiful moments. Or life-changing. I believe in miracles. I do not believe they're God-sent, though. Like, could you, like, what kind of, if you read the Old Testament, he's a fucking nightmare. So, like, I just don't even understand how anybody does, to be honest, other than the sort of thing you said earlier about how indoctrinated we are. And that really resonated with me, because I realized, like, I say I'm a Christian, I live by Christian principles, and I really try to do that. I read my Bible, I try to, you know, enact the life of Christ as best I can as a regular ass person, right? I don't do it for the sake of anything other than itself. I don't do it for expectation of rewards. I don't believe in heaven. I'm just doing it because I think it's the right way to live. That's it. But I never chose it. It was chosen for me. On some level, everything I'm saying might just be my need to reconcile myself psychologically to something that's been wired into me, right? I've been accused of being like a coward atheist before, and that might be true because that's so in me. It's so deep in my wiring, you know, that I'm never going to completely pull it out. So I always have to wonder, is my Christianity a negotiation with my past so I don't lose everything, or is it an honest choice I've made? And I don't know.
Well, I also think church is a good thing. Like, not going to church, I miss going to church. I don't necessarily miss religion, but the community, the friendships, and the things I got out of church, like, those were the things I enjoyed about religion the most. I think there's value there. We just have to find a new way to kind of create that.
All right, well, Jesus said, right, when two or three gather in my name, you'll be there.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely believe in God, and, you know, I don't know. In some ways, I don't know why. I could try to think about it and explain it, and there have been many people more eloquent than me who have put up a defense or an explanation for what they believe. But the way I've always felt about believing in God is, it's like, to me, believing in gravity. Like, I just know it's there. Like, I can decide I don't want to believe in gravity tomorrow, but it's still going to be a force functioning in the universe. Like, I'm not going to start floating or flying just because I decide gravity doesn't exist. And I've always just had that thought process with thinking about God. And I don't know if there's, like, I don't get up onto a soapbox and try to defend it or explain it, because I just don't know that that's ever possible. Like, we choose to believe the things we believe. Why do we believe anything we believe? I don't really know, actually. And to some degree, I think people choose to believe things for a variety of different reasons. And if that makes them happy, and they're not hurting anyone, who cares?
You know what? That's a great point, right? You know, as much as I, you know, might harangue a theist, right? At the end of the day, whatever you're doing, if it's making you, you know, act right to other people, and that's the key, I think. And like, Joe, when you said, like, churches are good, I'm like, I was at first like, oh, well, I know they're not. But then I was like, no, he's got a point. Especially because we keep each other in check on some level, but part of that is like a positive way, right? We don't want to disappoint each other, right? That, and as you said, like, Christina, like, believe in God, don't believe in God, agnostic, my weird, defiant, hot take religion. What are you doing? If you're treating people right, keep doing it, right? That's why I said earlier, like, keep the good Catholics, keep the Catholics, be Catholic, right? I know some really good Catholic people. But point being is, you don't need these institutions to do it. But I think sometimes, and you see this a lot in Texas, affiliation with the institution is a stand-in for being a real deep student of that religion. I just go to church Sunday mechanically. I don't have to, like, we have this very, very lazy, and this is especially true in Texas, this very lazy negative religion where you can prove you're a religious person by not doing certain things, which is not the point, right? It's about doing positive things, about creating goodness in yourself and in the lives of others, or being someone that lives for other people, not just living to be against certain people, right? I think we lose sight of that, and I think sometimes we get caught up in arguing, like Bart Simpson once said, we keep arguing about the stupid little differences and not the big stupid similarities. And Bart is a believer, Bart's a Christian, right? As far as something can be a Christian on The Simpsons. Yeah. But I think we do get caught up sometimes in if not the abstract conversations, and I know I prompted this, but in the consequences of those conversations. And I'll say this about the United States, like, you know, I'm often very critical, but it does, I don't know how this compares to other nations. I'm not saying we're exceptional in this regard, but it is true that we are allowed to have completely contrasting, even clashing views on something like religion, and still be friends, right? Still be a community, still have our sort of a church in a sense, you know? And I think that in our worst moments, we lose sight of that. And in our best moments, we try to enact it, although we've never been particularly good at including everyone, right? But in our best moments, we try, you know? And, you know, this conversation, if nothing else, is evidence of that.
Hey, we're married. And our views couldn't be more different on this topic.
What if God showed up? I was like, all right, I'm here. Y'all, they were right. Well, what changed? Does anything change for you? Do you do anything different?
I'd be real pissed off for about a lot of things. I'd probably roast him, like, immediately.
Yeah. That's funny, right? It's like you're 18 and you figured it out and you're doing all right, and now Dad wants to be part of my life. Like, no, dude.
Yeah. Where you been?
Look at this shit.
Where were you? How did you let it get this bad?
If God showed up, it's really interesting because we always talk about God as if he were male, right? We use the male pronouns. And I don't know why. I just have this sinking suspicion that God is like a really overworked mother, actually, behind the scenes. And like, you know, like that sort of mother who's trying to get everything done at the same time, but can't possibly. Like, if we all have competing prayers, like, it's not possible to answer all of them, right? And that that this poor, I almost feel sympathy. Like, this poor God mother person can't do it all. Yeah. Like, came down to earth to what? Throw up their hands? I don't know.
I used to think God was a woman, but I think a woman would do a better job.
I appreciate that.
That's what I think I'd do. I think I'd get drunk and make a scene. I don't know what that scene would be. I think I would be like, I would be the woman from the last unicorn. When she meets the last unicorn, waiting her whole life to meet a unicorn, meets her when she's this beat up older woman, and she says, "You come to me now when I look like this? Where are you when I was young and beautiful?" That's what I would say. I'd have that speech. One of the things that got us talking about this is that one of Christina's favorite movies is Spotlight, which you and me just watched at her request.
Yes.
So let's talk about Spotlight, because it was pretty good. Did it win Oscar for Best Picture?
Did it win Best Picture? Because I wasn't sure when I was watching it. It did win Best Picture and Best Screenplay.
What do you guys think? Christina, like, you want to start us off? This was your request?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to say that Spotlight is one of my favorite movies, it's not like a movie I love to sit down and watch. It's horribly depressing and really tense and anxiety-inducing. So it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's like Schindler's List or Shawshank Redemption. Yeah, like everyone needs to see it twice, but after that.
There was a moment in the movie, we were rewatching it the other night, where they are in the basement archives, several journalists poring over records, and I'm like, this movie has me at the edge of my seat, and all they are doing is archival research. Like, this is impressive as a script. But on top of that, I think the characters are really dynamic. I think it brings the impact of this scandal in the Catholic Church to life. Many of the characters are Catholics themselves and sort of have these moments toward the end of the movie where they start questioning themselves, their families, their place within organized religion and within this larger venture they're taking part in, which is the Boston Globe. So it would have been really easy, I think, to make a movie where the Spotlight column and the Boston Globe as a newspaper is the hero. And in some ways it is, because the story gets published and attention is finally brought to these victims and to this whole situation. However, the Globe buried the story, and the movie is very clear about that. And even the editor who's pushing this story forward, the Spotlight editor, that is, not the overall editor, but the Spotlight editor, realizes toward the end he was the one who buried it, right? So I think there's well, the Globe did something really good and they won the Pulitzer Prize that year for public service journalism, that the movie does a good job of sort of saying, like, you know, the Globe did something good, but it's not a total hero here. This could have been done 10 years ago.
Yeah. I did like that they really make it like there's no heroes to this story, really, other than maybe Ruffalo's character. They kind of make it seem like, oh, this is like, we were all complicit in this. We all let this go way too long. I thought it was a really well-made movie. It actually reminded me of a movie that would have been made 20 to 30 years ago, just in terms of its movie making. I thought it was really well-made. It doesn't pull any punches. It gets right to it immediately. Like, because while we're doing the story, we're doing the story, and now this is the story. I thought it was well-made in that regard, and there's some really good performances in it. I think Ruffalo's good. He had that one really big monologue where they're like, give me this right now. But other than that, I thought it was a really well put together movie. I thought if no one is really paying attention to this scandal, this is a good introduction to them. That era, like post 9/11, it really just like every day was an atrocity. Like it was huge. And this story kind of got buried, but I remember like this is back in the Battle Circus days.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember me and you having this exact same conversation about should the Catholic Church be around. I was very fucked the Catholic Church back then too.
And it's hard not to be.
I know, but this is the same conversation we had 15 years ago. Yeah. It's
that's a crazy moment. I'm remembering back to that now. I was a sophomore in high school, right? So 9/11 happens beginning of my sophomore year. This happens in the middle of my sophomore year.
Yeah.
That was a crazy time to be 15 years old. Yeah. You know? And then we still went to church on the weekends. And I was like, wait, what? What? Like,
yeah.
What is happening? Right? And everybody just said, you know, well, this is really horrible. But there are a few really bad people. A few bad apples that used all bad the time.
Yeah, well, the bunch is fucking spoiled, man. That's like, do you forget how the rest of that pithy euphemism goes? Like, the bunch has been spoiled. Time to make applesauce. Get the shit out of here.
Yeah. I would like to just say that I feel like bad apples are getting a bad because bad apples are not that harmful to us. Put them in the trash and be done with them. Or when apples don't they turn into alcohol at some point if you leave them out long enough?
I thought bad apples murdered black children.
Oh. I deliberately didn't make that analogy earlier. I'm glad you did it. Oh, man. All right. So Spotlight. good show. Spotlight. So, I thought what was interesting about, like, I want to talk a little bit about the story they're telling, because you said earlier, like, you're on the edge of your seat, and they're just flipping through, you know, catalogs, essentially, right? These old records, like HR stuff, right? It's not exciting material at all. It rivals Hamilton being able to make the Federalist Papers exciting because those are boring as shit too. But what was interesting though about, so I have a comment and then a question. So my comment is what I thought was really cool about the movie is that the way it is tensioned by borrowing so much of the structure of like detective fiction and war stories, right? So you have like our main character, we see him drink a lot, right? They're not overly doing it, but they're sort of subtly in your mind activating that detective fiction structure we're familiar with. So we have a detective figure who's sort of driven, but perhaps aloof, which I think Ruffalo's trying to play, right? He's got the weird affect, which maybe I'm just misreading his intensity. And then later it comes out, right? He comes out big, right? The guy who is somewhat detached ends up being real big because he comes out sort of like dog after bone, right? Thrill of the hunt. That's what it is at first, right? For Ruffalo's character. And maybe this is me reading him, right? That's the story I think they're telling. But like in a classic noir story, the thing that is ultimately discovered is how fucked up the world is, right? It's not about the crime anymore. It's about what the crime says about society, right? But it manages to do so without being dreary, self-important, or overly dark, right? The realism cuts that nicely in a way that keeps the energy of the film going, because you do weirdly get excited about like, oh, he's gonna get it, he's gonna get him. I was cheering, like, get him, like especially in those law scenes. Stanley Tucci, always a fucking pro, right? Great character.
Great.
He was so good. And at the end, inevitably when it happens and I come off the sort of high of the thrill because it's a well-told story, and then you're left in the wake of what you've learned, which is a classic noir story, right? Like, it's not caught up in being all performatively noir, right? It's just doing a good noir story. The second thing, and you guys can react to that if you want, but I'm going to throw it open as a question, as a sort of suggestion for our next topic, is we've been talking a lot about this movie's relationship to the Catholic scandal for obvious reasons. It moves the plot, and this has been the theme of our episode. But how do we feel about this as a representation of journalism? And I ask that, and putting Christine on the spot here a little bit, she has been a journalist in the past, you know, more part-time, side hustle types of things, but she's familiar with this world in a way that we're not. So, and it doesn't mean one obviously can answer over the other, but what do you guys think about how this movie as a story about journalists?
I mean, I think it's great. It's a little bit idealized insofar as, in my experience working as a journalist, I've never been given that much time or space to work on a single story. I think columns like Spotlight or things like that, any investigative reporting that goes really deep is incredibly important. These are the sorts of stories that need to be told and can't be told on a 24-hour news cycle. This is not the sort of story one could research in 3 hours and then put together for nighttime news, right? So I think there are only a few places left you can do that kind of journalism. The Boston Globe in 2002 was one of those places. I don't know if it still is. I genuinely say that, like, it might still be, and I'm just not informed. But there are very few places, I think, that do that type of coverage. So it almost feels like a throwback movie in some ways, like the good old age. At the top of the movie, they mentioned really briefly, oh, the Globe just got bought out by the New York Times. And so it's like, oh, man, this is the beginning of the end, right? With very few independent papers left. And the Globe had that reputation for years until, was it 99 or something that it was bought out? I can't recall. Late 90s.
Yeah.
But man, that was a really good local paper. People like the Globe around here, and I think it's based on its legacy from the past. But there were a lot of good papers. And now, especially, I don't know what's going on right now with the way people look at the media, but it's turned much more so than it ever has into sort of business model marketplace where people are opting in and out of certain viewpoints rather than actually looking at what's going on in the world.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I was watching it, I was like, this is a love letter to old media. It actually achieved some of the things that David Simon wasn't able to achieve in season 5 of The Wire, because he touched on a lot of this, how media was changing. And really early, be careful, this is how media is changing. Like, newspapers and things we need, like local courts, all that's going away. And this movie really hits on a lot of that. Because nowadays, stories like this don't get enough time to build. Occasionally, you'll get a long and get investigative story, but it's not like it used to be, where media really focused on these kind of things. But I also think media should also hold itself accountable. Like, sometimes a little too love lettery, because, like the movie says, the Globe buried this story multiple times where they had big information. So it's, in one way, it's a love letter to a time, like, I wish we still had stuff like this, but the whole thing wasn't great either.
Right.
It still was guilty of getting things, missing things, getting things wrong. And it actually had more power back then because it didn't have as many voices online. So it's both good and bad.
Yeah,
I think you sort of nailed it there, Joe, because as you said, like, and I didn't make this connection that you just made. I think it's really insightful. Is The Wire season 5 trying to do the same story, and the Spotlight does it better in less time. Part of it is anchored in a real moment, so it doesn't have to imagine the nuances. It can just, you know, represent them. But part of it is also the benefit of hindsight, right? Because they can see clearly into a past, right? However, with the distance that you need for hindsight also comes the potential for nostalgia, which covers things up, right? Like you said, Eric, it was, you know, idealistic in a tone that implied, not apologizing for it, but almost like a disclaimer. I'm of the mind that I'm fine with that. Like, I actually would say, like, be idealistic, right? I want ideals, right? I think just don't be naive about them. And this movie's not naive, right?
No.
But I don't want, like, this sort of, like, the idea that idealism is like a bad thing. Oh, he's idealistic. Oh, that's just idealistic. Like, good. Fucking believe in something, motherfucker, or leave me alone, right? You know, that being said, you always run the risk of sliding into romanticizing something, and that is naive, right? That's not. Romance is always naive, right? It's not. That's the kind of the idea. Now, when I say romanticizing, I mean small R, not capital R, the whole other thing. But, right, so it's nostalgic in a way that sometimes is like you said, Joan, I think you're right, that it's self-implications are sometimes even them framed as another way to be nostalgic, because back then we admitted to our mistakes. you know? Yeah. And I say that as not so much a criticism, but it's just the reality of the narrator telling me. I like the movie. I wish its version of journalism were the real version of journalism. As you said, the past is never that neat. And the movie admits to that tacitly. It definitely nostalgizes as a way to express an ideal, which is what happens when you do a movie like this, I think. I'm not against it. The movie seems to be aware of it, but at the same time, it's also fair to point that out.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is I started writing for newspapers in 2003. I wrote for them on a weekly basis, sometimes one story a week, sometimes up to 8 to 10 stories a week, depending on whether I was home and that was my summer job, or whether I was at school and it was something I was doing once a week. So I did that for 10 years straight. And then after that point, I have continued to freelance periodically. A few times a year, I'll write a more in-depth story, like I did one on recycling this summer in Worcester for Worcester Magazine. But the point of this is to say I was involved in mostly smaller publications, although I did work very briefly for ABC6 in Providence for a magazine as well. The reality I see that's problematic, that is not represented in the Boston Globe, is that most journalists I know, in Spotlight rather, most journalists I know are good people. You know, not all of them, but most of them are good people trying to do the right thing, trying to be objective, trying to tell stories that matter. And the single biggest obstacle they have is time. That they have to file stories too quickly, and there are too few of them to go around, too much to cover. And too much emphasis, I think, is put on national stories when that's what people want to hear about. That's a good talking point. We all want to get Trump's latest hot take on something. But the reality is what probably matters more in our local community, for example, in Worcester, we're having a primary on September the 4th. And I'm trying to desperately find information on this, right? Like, it's out there, but and I can definitely find it, but it's coming from partisan sources. So I'm really looking for the newspaper coverage of this to try to get a bit more of an objective take. It's hard to find. So I think that's the biggest problem right now. And so in contrast, I don't know if it was ever as good as that, you know, as good as it was in Spotlight. But I think even back then, Spotlight was that column. You see them actually kind of weighing whether or not they should keep it in that movie. So I think even that's like a sort of special case. I don't think it was ever that good everywhere.
Yeah. It's sad because we let capitalism destroy our press.
Yeah. Well, that and the rollbacks during the Clinton years.
Yeah. That is largely true. But I think it was also true is that capitalism gave us our press in the first place, right? Because Pulitzer and the other guy, name I'm forgetting, Hearst, owned all the papers and started most of them, right? They were two oil magnates, right? So while there's definitely been moments where journalism breaks away and its best moments, it provides a real service, right? But the part of the idealism here, and one thing I thought the movie did a missed opportunity for, but maybe it just genuinely did not interfere as much as it did, was the reality of having been bought out and you're no longer independent, right? They're now by the New York Times. In which case, I thought Liev Schreiber was a really interesting character because they definitely set him up. At first, I was like, Sabretooth, what are you doing here? And then I was like, this is an interesting character because he set him up as being the number-crunching cheapskate that's going to downsize everything and micromanage their economics, right? And it turns out that he's not, that he actually is doing his best to protect the mission of the paper, right?
He's one of the few pure good people in the narrative.
Not just pure good, but also far seeing, right? Not just a dog chasing cars. As you said, like Christina, they want to go quickly because they got to sell papers, right? In terms of the idealism, right? I do think we do tend to sort of lionize or idealize the idea of a free press, which we should, right? And you know, there was a lot of, you know, hay made about Ocasio-Campo not inviting the press to an event with voters, right?
Do you mean Ocasio-Cortez?
Yes.
AOC?
Yeah, that's right. I'm down with the AOC. I'm 100% on board. And she got flack for not having invited the press, right? And on the one hand, I'm like, you should have, the press should be allowed everywhere. The free press should be allowed everywhere. But then I saw some of the people who were complaining. I'm like, motherfucker, you're not the free press. You're paid for. Like, you're owned by a corporation. You are not the free press. You are disqualified. We are allowed to exclude you Like, if you're from CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, like, are we really going to consider Fox News free press? Like, give me a fucking break. If you're part of one of these, and this is like 90% of papers now that are owned by a corporation that isn't a conglomerate of papers. I might give an excuse if it's a corporation of only other newspapers. That maybe I'll consider still independent, right? But if you're owned by Rupert Murdoch, or if you're owned by, you know
Bezos
or Disney, you're not the free press. Like, we can say you know.
The funny thing is, the papers that were the papers that are still owned by a single person or a small corporation are probably these very, very local papers that people think are junk and that are often the free papers in your community.
Mm-hmm. Those are
right?
the ones you should read.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you, you know, these are the papers I used to work for. I worked for a company of papers. It was about 12 or so papers owned by one person who I knew. Met him. He was a single person who owned this. I was the only one covering these little Board of Selectmen meetings in these small towns in Massachusetts. Not glorious work, but, you know, locally important, right? And nobody else was covering it. Like, we didn't need another take on what was going on nationally in those small papers. Everyone else had that covered. So, yeah, that weirdly, probably some of the best news is coming out of the papers people are discounting, really, or not looking at. That's my two cents.
Well, do either of you look at Vice on HBO?
Occasionally.
I watch it occasionally.
But I had HBO, but in years.
Well, they, like 2 days ago, they did one where they just sent paparazzos to Washington to see how that would look like to see what that would be like. It was just like Hollywood. It was the exact same thing. Like, nothing changed. And the paparazzos were just like, oh, yeah, we could do this. Like, I think that's where we're headed, is TMZ political. Like, ugh. I think that's our sad future.
Yeah. Well, first thing, if you don't watch your news, you won't have to deal with that. And so don't watch your news, right? Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I like the idea of having some politicians' privacy be ruined, because fuck them. Like, as long as you are going to take free healthcare but not give us some, fuck you. I don't give a shit. What? I don't give a shit if you never get to eat a taco again, Kristen Nielsen. Like, you can fucking get shamed every time you go out, step out your house. All right. Anything else? I think we're at the end here. Any last takes? Any last words?
Oh, no. I just want to thank the movie for not even having the actors do fucking bad Boston accents.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad they didn't even have them try.
Right.
Just, just talk like a normal person.
Yeah, my God, that's one of my pet peeves.
Shout out to The Departed, most accents I've ever heard.
Oh my God, that movie was painful. I was laughing through that whole movie.
Oh, maybe that'll be the theme song for this episode, that fucking, was it Dropkick Murphys song?
Oh, yeah. For some reason, I wrote down unregistered sex offender. I don't know why.
That could be the alternate title of this movie, I guess. Oh, yeah. So, that moment. I'll close with this. That moment where the guy with the mustache, the guy in my head I call Kurt Vonnegut, he found out one of them was in his neighborhood.
Yeah, that was a great moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he warned his kids, he had it on the fridge, don't go there.
Yeah.
Would you have told your neighbors right away? Or at the risk of, you know, hurting the story in some unforeseen way, right? Because it's all, you know, loose lips sink ships, right?
I'd have told my neighbors.
Yeah, I feel like I would have said something. I don't know what I would have said, but something. They did have that sort of built-in sort of moral excuse for him not to tell people, which was to say that they kept repeating over and over again, if all we do is nail a couple of priests, then it'll get swept under the rug again. We have to wait. We have to do it well, and we have to get to the heart of the issue, which is the fact that these higher-ups are not doing anything about this when it's reported for things to change. I think that had some... It was a nice built-in excuse narratively for the characters to sort of not act or not give things away or not speak too soon.
Objectively, I think they're right. I think that's the right choice strategically and long-term benefit, right? The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, right? That's not always the case, but I think it is the case in this instance. With that being said, I would tell everybody. I already know. This would be like God again. I would get drunk and make a scene. I'd be up and down the street like, what the fuck? I'd be throwing bottles at the dude's house. I know it. And that is not the right choice. That is what I would do emotionally. I know myself.
I can't be rational with pedophiles.
Me neither, man. Me neither. This shit is fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been a lot of emotions around this house these last couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on to talk about all this.
Absolutely. We will have you back for the travel episode.
Yeah, it'll be way more upbeat. It felt weird to just be so upbeat after all of this stuff that's been going on. Thanks for giving me my little space to rant.
We always got to find a way to laugh at the end. Or don't go to bed upset, right? Go to bed laughing. Whatever it takes, that's how I feel. I know some people would disagree, but that's what I do for my mental health personally. I got to find a way to laugh after talking about it, or I'm just going to sit in my stomach and rot.